You're on a GLP-1. Your appetite is changing, your cravings quiet down, and food noise is finally fading. But now you're wondering, how do I manage my side effects? What do I eat to stay strong? How do I break through a plateau? Because reaching your weight loss goals can take more than meds. That's where Weight Watchers Med Plus comes in. The support designed to help you navigate what comes next. With trusted experts who guide you, food plans that work with your body, support to help manage side effects, plus access to GLP-1 medication. Weight Watchers Med Plus is designed to help you lose more weight. Watch it work. Get started today at WeightWatchers.com. All medical services are provided through our affiliated medical group, Weight Watchers Clinic. Medications require eligibility and prescription. Individual results may vary. See site for more details.
A dirt road between Randolph and Monroe counties, Missouri, July 23, 1877. A spring wagon moving through open farmland. No shade, no trees close to the road, just flat summer heat pressing down on everything. The woman sitting beside the driver is 58 years old. Her name is Martha Parrish. She has been married to the man holding the reins for 24 years. He is Dr. Jephthah Calloway Parrish, a country physician, a Confederate veteran, and a man who, until this morning, had refused to do what his wife and daughter begged him to do. Their daughter Susan is 20 years old. She has come home with an infant son and bruises she can no longer hide, begging to be taken away from her husband. The doctor has finally agreed. They are driving out to collect her and bring her to her brother's house in Howard County. A younger daughter rides in the back of the wagon. It should be a simple trip, 30 miles of dirt road, and done. The sound of a horse coming fast. A rider from a side road, armed, a double-barreled shotgun across the saddle. James Hayden Brown, they called him Hayde, is 21 years old. He is Susan's husband. He has found out where they are going. The confrontation is immediate. Hayde fires at Dr. Parrish first, wounding him badly. The doctor slumps. The wagon stops. Then Hayde orders Martha out. A 58-year-old woman standing in the dust of a Missouri road. July heat. The barrel of a shotgun. Hello, friend. Welcome to Foul Play. This is season 40. 50 states, 50 crimes, 250 years of American history. Tonight is episode 4, Missouri and North Carolina. Both stories tonight are about love and what it costs. Both are about men who said they loved women and then destroyed them. And both end in something no one planned. Not just death, but music of a kind. In Missouri, a suicide pact, a double coffin, two bodies buried in each other's arms. In North Carolina, a murder ballad that has carried a dead woman's name for more than 130 years. Case A begins in the summer of 1877. A family called Parrish, a son-in-law called Hayde Brown, a young woman trying to escape a violent husband, and a mother who paid for that escape with her life. Martha Emily Fort Parrish was born in 1818, most likely in Kentucky, one of the upper South states, whose families had poured into Missouri's river counties in the decades before the war. She married Dr. Jephthah Holloway Parrish on November 2, 1853, in Randolph County, Missouri. A doctor's wife, a mother of five children, including two sets of twins, born in 1854 and 1857. To understand what Martha's daily life looked like, you have to understand what it meant to be a country physician's wife in rural Missouri. Patients came to the house. The practice shaped the rhythms of everything. The knocks at odd hours, the travel, the community obligations. Dr. Parrish was described in county records as an old and respected citizen. To be his wife was to be visible, known, and expected to hold the household together while he was gone. And Martha had held it together through worse than most. Randolph County set in the heart of Little Dixie, settled by families from Kentucky and Tennessee who had brought tobacco, enslaved people, and Southern codes of honor with them. The Civil War had torn the region apart. Guerrilla violence, burned roads, neighbors turning on neighbors. By 1877, Martha had survived all of it. Her twin daughters were grown. Her husband was still practicing. She must have believed the worst was behind them. Then Susan brought trouble home. The elopement came in early 1876. Susan was 18. Hade Brown was 19. And the Parrish family opposed the marriage with everything they had. They knew the Brown name. Hade's father, Bill Brown, had murdered a man named William Penny in 1865. Bill Brown was then killed by his own brother-in-law for beating his wife. The pattern was there. The warning was clear. It wasn't enough. The marriage deteriorated immediately. Hade Brown's temper, described as ungovernable, manifested in beatings from the first weeks. Period accounts describe him as ever ready to shoot, cut, or kill whoever or whatever crossed his path. Susan endured it through the birth of their son. What makes this significant is the legal reality Susan faced. In 1877 Missouri, there was no consistent legal prohibition against domestic assault. A husband's authority within the home was treated as nearly absolute. Susan could not obtain a protective order. She could not have Hade arrested for beating her. Physical escape was the only option available, and even that required her father's help. By July 1877, Susan had reached the limit. She gathered up her infant son, left the marital home while Hade was away in neighboring Monroe County, and arrived at her parents' door. She told them her life was in constant danger. Dr. Parrish initially refused to intervene. Entering a son-in-law's domestic authority was an act of significant social defiance, not simply a practical rescue. Then he consented. July 23rd, 1877. The spring wagon. Dr. Parrish, Martha, and a young daughter set out to collect Susan and take her to her brother's home in Howard County. Hade Brown rode up armed with a double-barreled shotgun. He fired at Dr. Parrish first, wounding him gravely. Then he ordered Martha out of the wagon. He shot her at close range. Martha Parrish died on the side of a Missouri dirt road. She was 58 years old. Hade fled Missouri immediately. His wife's mother was dead. His father-in-law was bleeding in a wagon. His wife was somewhere behind him. And he ran. Hade Brown fled to Minnesota. He lived as a free man for roughly a year before he was recognized on the street in Rochester and arrested. He was extradited back to Missouri. The trial in Moberly, where the Randolph County Auxiliary Courthouse sat, did not begin until February 1879, 19 months after the murder. By then, Martha was buried. The witnesses had lived in the aftermath for over a year. The community had long since decided what it thought of Hayde Brown. The trial records tell us what the courtroom heard. Witness testimony established the pattern of abuse. Other witnesses placed Brown at the scene with the weapon. Brown himself took the stand. He acknowledged he must have shot Martha Parrish, but claimed not to remember it clearly. He said he never had anything against Mrs. Parrish personally. His quarrel, he said, was with a doctor. What's striking about this admission is what it reveals. Martha was not Hayde's target. She was the person who was there. He wanted Dr. Parrish. He got Martha. When Hayde lost control, the nearest person absorbed it. That is the arithmetic of this kind of violence. It does not require a reason. It requires proximity. The jury returned a guilty verdict. The judge sentenced Hayde Brown to hang March 26, 1879. Brown's attorneys appealed to the Missouri Supreme Court. The execution was stayed. In May 1880, the court affirmed the conviction. A new date was set, June 25th, 1880. As the execution approached, Susan made a decision. She was living in Kansas City with a family named Fisher. She obtained a large dose of morphine and smuggled it into the jail for Hayde. The plan was simple. He would die on his own terms, before the state could hang him. Susan intended to follow. On June 20, 1880, the morphine was discovered and confiscated. The next day, June 21st, Susan shot herself at the Fisher home in Kansas City. She was 22 years old. Before she died, she wrote a letter. She told Mrs. Fisher she loved her husband more than the world. She asked that her infant son be raised by her own relatives, not the Browns. 5 days later, on June 25, 1880, Hayde Brown was led to a scaffold in Huntsville, the Randolph County seat. Approximately 15,000 people gathered, an enormous crowd for a rural Missouri county. He was hanged. The execution is not the end of this story. What came after? The coffin, the burial, the arrangement of two bodies in the dark is the image that carried the Hayde Brown case through a century of Missouri oral history. That is where Case A ends. After the execution, Hayde's body was cut down and placed in a specially constructed coffin, larger than standard. The body was transported to the Moberly Train Depot. Susan's body had been held in Kansas City. It was placed on the same train. At Moberly, Susan was transferred into the same coffin as Hayde. Their hands were arranged, resting on each other, giving the appearance of embracing. They were buried together at Swindell Cemetery, 4 miles south of Madison, Monroe County, Missouri. A woman who had been beaten by this man chose to die beside him, chose to be buried in his arms. Susan's love for Hayde, documented in her own letter to Mrs. Fisher, is not something the record lets us simplify. Abusive relationships produce exactly this kind of attachment, isolation, intermittent reinforcement. Total social dependence on the person inflicting the harm. Susan's love does not diminish what Haight did to her, to her mother, to her father, but it adds a dimension of grief that cannot be reduced to good and evil. There is a coffin in a Missouri cemetery where two people lie in each other's arms. One of them killed the other's mother. Both of them were dead. Neither of them was older than 24. Dr. Jephthah Holloway Parrish survived. He lived until February 4, 1892, 15 years after the murder of his wife. He died in Clifton Hill, Missouri, a widower who had outlived his daughter and buried his wife's killer. The infant son Susan named in her final letter was placed with the Parrish family connections. He grew up without either parent. Martha is buried in Thomas Hill Cemetery, Monroe County, Missouri. She has no surviving obituary, no memorial notice in the digitized record. Her Find a Grave entry notes she was killed by her son-in-law. She was 58 years old. She died trying to save her daughter. A double coffin in a Missouri cemetery. Two hands arranged to look like an embrace. This is how the Haight Brown story ends. Not with justice, though justice came, but with a love that refused to make sense. Both of tonight's stories are about men who claimed love as their motive and left behind bodies as their evidence. In Missouri, Haight Brown killed because he could not accept losing his wife. In North Carolina, 15 years later, and 1,000 miles east, a man named Peter DeGraff killed because he could not accept what his love had cost him. The oldest story there is. Desire that turns to ownership. Ownership that turns to rage. And rage that leaves behind nothing but a story. In Missouri, the story was a coffin. In North Carolina, it was a song. Winston, North Carolina, July 20th, 1892. A young woman leaves her employer's house in the evening. She is 18 years old. Her name is Ellen Smith. She has received a note from a man she loves, a man who has told her he wants to make things right. He has asked her to meet him in the woods behind the Zinzendorf Hotel, the grandest building in Winston, a four-story resort that opened just 72 days earlier. She goes. She does not come back. Mary Ellen Smith was born January 28, 1874, in Yadkin County, North Carolina. She will be known as Ellen. She arrived in Winston around 1891. All right, real quick, did you know there's an online cannabis company that ships federally legal THC right to your door? And they figured out how to combine THC with functional ingredients, create gummies, baked goods, and flower, for whatever type of buzz you want. I'm talking about Mood.com. They have an incredible line of cannabis gummies, and you can get 20% off your first order at Mood.com with promo code Shane, S-H-A-N-E. They've found products for every vibe to help you sleep, get focused, feel happy and euphoric, even for better sex. I've been into their Sleepy Time Advanced gummies. After a long week digging through case files, my brain does not want to shut off. I pop one of these about 15 minutes before bed, and it's like someone finally hits the off switch. No grogginess the next morning either. Beyond gummies, Mood also has flower, pre-rolls, bakery treats, and beverages. Everything ships discreetly right to your door. Best of all, not only is every Mood product backed by a 100-day satisfaction guarantee, but as I mentioned earlier, listeners get 20% off their first order with Shane, S-H-A-N-E. So head to mood.com, find the functional gummy that matches what you're looking for, and don't forget to use promo code Shane at checkout to save 20% off your first order. Try it today at mood.com. Approximately 17 years old, looking for work. Winston in 1891 was a tobacco city in full transformation. R.J. Reynolds had founded his company in 1875. By 1892, his net worth had reached $200,000. Warehouses, factories, electric lights in the streets. The smell of cured tobacco in the air at all hours. For a young woman from a rural Piedmont county, this was the closest thing to a city she had likely ever seen. Ellen found work as a maid in a merchant's household. Indoor work, regular wages, a room of her own. A step up from Yadkin County farm labor. But domestic service in 1892 meant dependents, housing, references, social protection. All of it came from the employer. Pregnancy meant dismissal. Loss of a reference letter meant unemployment. Social disgrace meant ruin. She met Peter DeGraff sometime in 1891. He was about 21, handsome, a ladies' man, fond of drinking and gambling. His father, Anthony, had immigrated from Bordeaux, France, an unusual immigration path for this part of North Carolina. Peter had grown up in Forsyth County. He was local. He was charming. And Ellen couldn't have known what charming meant in this case. She couldn't have known that the attentions of a young man who seemed to offer romance and commitment would become the most dangerous thing she ever accepted. Ellen became pregnant. She traveled home to Yadkin County to have the baby. DeGraff reportedly accompanied her. The infant was either stillborn or died shortly after birth. Then DeGraff denied paternity. He accused Ellen of unfaithfulness, a calculated deflection that placed the full weight of social stigma on her. He cut off the relationship entirely. At some point, he threatened to shoot her if she tried to contact him again. Ellen returned to Winston. She tried to hold on. From a distance, this looks like a failure of self-preservation. In context, it was the constrained options of a young woman in 1892 who had staked her security on a relationship that now needed to be real for her situation to be survivable. If the baby was her fault, if the relationship was casual, then everything she had risked became visible to her employer, her community, and anyone who might hire her next. She needed DeGraff's love to be true. July 17, 1892. A major quarrel between Ellen and DeGraff at her employer's home. Witnesses heard him threaten violence. July 18, 1892. DeGraff sent a note, conciliatory. He said he loved her. He asked her to meet him on the evening of July 20th, near the Zinzendorf Hotel in the West End. The note was hope. Ellen had no way to know it was a summons to the last place she would ever stand. But before we get to that moment, a door. A July evening, a man waiting in the trees. The investigation that followed would hinge on what investigators found when they arrived the next morning. Evening of July 20th, 1892. Ellen left her employer's home and walked to the woods behind the Zinzendorf Hotel. She was shot through the left breast at close range. Powder burns on her clothing. A single shot severing a large artery near her heart. she died in the woods. Ellen Smith was dead. The man who killed her was already running. And somewhere behind him, in the brush 10 steps from a path, a young woman lay in the July heat with a note in her pocket and an apron hung from a nearby branch.
Morning of July the 21st, 1892. Patty Pratt, a laundry worker, walking to her job at the Zinzendorf Hotel, found Ellen Smith's body in a thick brush about 10 steps from a path. The July heat had already done its work. Flies. The smell of a summer morning gone wrong. One detail complicates a clean reading. Ellen's white apron had been removed and hung from a nearby branch. Her body had been arranged, not thrown down. Whether this was grief, guilt, performance, or some mixture that refuses a name, the gesture does not resolve. In Ellen's clothing, investigators found the note from Peter de Graaf. It summoned her to the meeting place. It was the prosecution's most damning evidence before a single witness was called. One more detail. Late on the evening of July the 20th, or perhaps early on July the 21st, a young man in a brown suit and a black derby hat approached several people and told them where to find a body in the woods behind the hotel. His identity was never confirmed. Whether this was guilt, bravado, or something else entirely, the record does not say. De Graaf fled Winston within days. He travelled to the Mount Airy area in Surrey County, took a job at a sawmill under the name H.D. Hendricks. He stayed for nearly 11 months. Meanwhile, the Zinzendorf Hotel, the newest symbol of Winston's ambitions, the building behind which Ellen died, burnt to the ground on Thanksgiving Day, November the 24th, 1892. A fire that began in the hotel laundry spread through the enormous wooden structure. Fire engines from both Winston and Salem found no water pressure to fight it. The hotel was rubble in under 2 hours. The place where Ellen was murdered erased itself within 5 months. De Graaf was arrested in June 1893. The trial before Superior Court Judge Robert W. Winston began August the 11th, 1893. 4 days. The courthouse packed, described in one account as like sardines. Witnesses placed De Graaf at the scene. Others testified he had beaten Ellen and threatened to shoot her before the murder. The note in her clothing was entered as evidence. Ellen's Aunt Rosa sat in the front row throughout. The family's vigil in a gallery that excluded most women as a matter of propriety. De Graaf took the stand and denied everything. Newspapers noted he was, in their words, a pretty big liar, who told contradictory stories to different visitors. The jury convicted him, sentenced to death. February the 8th, 1894, Liberty Street, Winston. Approximately 6,000 people gathered, the largest execution crowd in Forsyth County history. De Graaf sang hymns from the scaffold with the crowd. When he indicated he wished to make a final statement, he said plainly, "I killed Ellen." He said he loved her. He said he had intended to marry her. He said he was drunk. He was hanged. It was the last public execution in Winston-Salem's history. He was approximately 24 years old. De Graaf's scaffold confession confirmed what the evidence had already established, but his final words, love, marriage, drunkenness, opened a door the verdict had tried to close. That door would stay open for more than a century, kept ajar by something no one in the courtroom or standing on Liberty Street could have predicted. A song.
Ellen Smith is buried in Liberty Cemetery, Winston, Salem, Forsyth County. She was 18 years old. She would have turned 19 in January. But Ellen Smith did not disappear. Before De Graaf was even arrested, something else had already begun. In the months after her death, her story started to circulate, not through newspapers alone, but through music. A murder ballad, set to the tune of the hymn, "How Firm a Foundation." A melody familiar to anyone who had been to church in Western North Carolina. Ellen's name became singable. The ballad, Poor Ellen Smith, became one of the most recorded murder ballads in American folk history. It has been sung across the Appalachian region for more than 130 years. If you have spent any time with Appalachian or old-time American music, you likely have heard her name. You may not have known it was real. There were two competing versions of the ballad. The earlier one presented DeGraff as an innocent man who wrongly executed. A standard wrongful hanging narrative, common in 19th century folk tradition. That version generated enough controversy that singing it was reportedly suppressed. The later version, the one that survived, the one that carried, told its story differently. Both share one thing. Ellen's name is in the title. Murder ballads were the era's true crime. They processed violence. They assigned blame. They expressed grief. They circulated stories without the need for print literacy. Through voices, through porches, through church halls and general stores, and crossroads. They were how communities made sense of what had happened to them. Poor Ellen Smith did what newspapers and courtrooms could not. It made her permanent. The song kept Ellen from the anonymity that claims most women killed by domestic partners in the 19th century. It is an imperfect monument. Some versions center the killer's feelings rather than the victim's life. But it is a monument. Two women, two states, 15 years apart. Martha Emily Fort Parrish was 58 years old, a doctor's wife in rural Missouri, killed on a dirt road because she was trying to help her daughter escape a violent husband. Ellen Smith was 18. A domestic servant in a booming North Carolina tobacco city, lured to the woods behind a grand hotel by a man who had already told her he would shoot her. Martha died in the open on a summer road in front of her husband. Ellen died alone in the brush with a note in her pocket. Both deaths were met by enormous public attention. 15,000 at a scaffold in Missouri, 6,000 on Liberty Street in Winston. These were not quiet tragedies. They were community events, processed through the mechanisms each era had available. Newspapers, courtrooms, gallows. And both stories survived their century. In Missouri, the Hayde Brown case endured as oral history. A double coffin, two bodies arranged like they were embracing, buried in a corner of Swindell Cemetery. Susan's love letter to Mrs. Fisher. 15,000 people watching a 24-year-old hanged for what his father had taught him. In North Carolina, Ellen Smith's name outlasted everyone involved. The ballad did what memory alone could not. Her name is still sung in Appalachian hollows and on folk stages, 130 years after a laundry worker found her body in the July heat. Both cases fall in the decades after the Civil War, when America was rebuilding, expanding, modernizing, and the legal and social protections for women had barely changed. Martha Parrish had no mechanism to stop Hayde Brown before he arrived on that road. Ellen Smith had no legal recourse against a man who denied their child and threatened her life. The machinery of justice caught both killers, but only after the women were dead. Martha Emily Fort Parrish, Ellen Smith. Until next time, good night, friend.
Poor Ellen Smith, how was she bound? Shot through the heart, lying cold on the ground. Her clothes were all scattered and thrown on the ground. The blood marked the spot where poor Ellen was found. Sleeping in some lonesome old grave.